Time. It's a funny thing, I was just staring at a clock this morning, just watching the seconds tick. And it's this seamless flow, right? One second just bleeds into the next. But then you look at the economy, or at least the way we talk about the economy.
It's completely different. It's chunky.
It's so chunky
We get
sometimes.
quarterly reports, annual GDP, monthly jobs numbers. It's like a slideshow. Click, here's a picture. Click, here's the next one.
Exactly. A movie at one frame per second. But the actual economy doesn't just, take a nap between those
Not
frames.
at all. Factories are running. People are buying things every single millisecond. Interest is always accruing.
So today, we're going to try and bridge that gap. We're doing a deep dive into a set of materials all about Chapter 9, Continuous Time Analytical Techniques.
And this is a really fundamental shift in thinking. We're basically moving from the world of algebra and what are called difference equations, those steps you mentioned,
Wait.
into the world of calculus and differential equations.
Huh. Okay, I have to be honest. When I see the words calculus and then differential equations, my palms get a little sweaty.
I get it.
I think a lot of us have some high school math trauma. Is this going to be a huge head?
I promise it won't be. Actually, the whole mission today is to show you why, surprisingly, the calculus version is often easier.
Easier.
It's cleaner, it's more elegant.
Elegant is a strong word for math, but okay, I'll trust you. So let's start with the basics. The sources really draw this line between discrete time and continuous time. Help me visualize that.
Okay, think about it like this. In discrete time, you're looking at snapshots. Imagine you're checking your bank account, but you're only allowed to look at it on December 31st each year.
Okay, so I see the balance on New Year's Eve, then I basically close my eyes for 364 days.
Right. You open them again the next New Year's Eve, and poof, the balance has jumped up.
Yeah.
All the interest, all the spending, it's just collapsed into that one single leap from time t to time t plus one.
Year one, year two, year three.
Very.
Slocky.
Very blocky. But in continuous time, you're watching that account at every single instant. It's a flow. Investment isn't something that happens at the end of the year. It's happening right now.
So it's the difference between walking up a staircase and like sliding up a ramp.
That's a perfect analogy.
But the source said something that kind of confused me. They said discrete time is good for data, which makes sense, but continuous time is better for paper and pencil solutions. Why? I would have thought the blocks were easier.
You would think so, but the algebra gets messy. You have to keep track of all these time subscripts, k sub t, c sub t minus one. It gets
Chopped up,
cluttered.
that's it. But yeah.
Precisely. In continuous time, we can use derivatives. And a lot of the time, that lets us solve the whole problem with one clean formula.
Okay, so let's get into the toolbox. If we're on the ramp instead of the stairs, how do we write things down? The source introduces Newton notation.
Yes.
They introduce the dot.
The dot. It's iconic in economics.
So you'll see a variable, say capital, written as K of T. And then to show it's changing, they put a little dot right over the K. What is that dot really telling me?
Okay, forget the textbook for a second. Imagine you're driving a car.
I'm driving.
If you want to know how far you traveled in the last hour, that's discrete time. You check the odometer at 1 o'clock, check it again at 2 o'clock, and find the difference.
Okay, distance traveled. Got it.
But if you want to know what's happening right now, at this exact instant, you look at the speedometer.
Ah.
That needle isn't telling you how far you went, it's telling you the rate at which you're moving.
So the dot is the speedometer.
The dot is the speedometer, it's the time derivative, the instantaneous rate of change.
That makes so much more sense. So when I see a dot, I shouldn't think amount, I should think velocity.
Exactly. And that leads right to growth rates. If you take that velocity, the dot, and divide it by the current amount. So k dot over k, you get the growth rate.
Which brings us to the aha moment in the reading for me, the part about exponential growth.
It is a beautiful connection.
So in the discrete blocky world, we're all used to compound interest. You multiply by, one plus gamma raised to the power of t.
Right, like 1.05 to the t.
The source says if you chop those time periods up smaller and smaller, from years to days to nanoseconds, that formula actually transforms.
It becomes the exponential function. It becomes E,
Euler's number.
the famous E. It pops up everywhere in nature because it's the perfect description of smooth, continuous growth. So the formula becomes your starting value times E raised to the power of gamma times T.
So E is just what happens to compound interest if you check your account infinitely often.
That's a perfect way to put it. And because we can use E, we get access to this amazing mathematical cheat code.
You're talking about the log trick.
The log trick.
Okay, walk me through this, because whenever I see logarithms, my brain just wants to shut down. Why is this so useful?
It's all about simplification. Think about one of the most famous and frankly ugliest equations in economics, the Cobb-Douglas production function.
Oh boy, remind us.
It says output equals productivity times capital to some power times labor to some other power. It's this big string of multiplication and exponents.
Yeah, it's hard to just look at that and know what's driving what.
Exactly. It's a tangle. But here's the magic. If you take the natural log of that equation and then you take its derivative with respect to time,
what happens?
The logs turn all that multiplication into addition, and they pull the exponents down and turn them into simple weights.
So the multiplication sign literally becomes a plus sign.
Yes. That messy equation suddenly becomes a simple sum. The growth rate of output just equals the growth rate of productivity plus the growth rate of capital plus the growth rate of labor.
Wait, that is actually huge, because then you can do what they call growth accounting.
Exactly. You can look at an economy growing at, say, 3%, and you can ask who gets the credit. You can say, okay, 1% came from more machines, 1% from more workers, and that leftover 1%. That must have been technology.
And you just couldn't do that easily with the original messy version.
Not nearly as easily. The log trick makes it all so transparent.
Okay, I'm sold in the toolbox. We have the dot for the speedometer, we have E for smooth growth, and we have the log trick to make things simple.
We're ready to build a model.
But economics isn't just about watching things. It's about making choices. Optimization.
Right, this is where we go from describing the world to trying to figure out the best thing to do in it. And the central problem is usually the consumption-saving problem.
The story of my life. How much do I spend on stuff today versus how much do I save so I'm not eating cat food when I'm 80?
That's the one. Maximizing utility over your lifetime. Now, in the discrete world, we use a tool called the Lagrangian.
Which is that massive headache-inducing formula with the Greek letter lambda.
That's the one. But for the continuous world, the source introduces a new character, the Hamiltonian.
Which sounds like a Broadway musical. I'm guessing less singing.
Significantly less singing. But it's a very powerful tool. It forces you to distinguish between two different kinds of variables.
Okay, what are they?
First, you have control variables. These are the choices you can make right now in this instant.
Like deciding to buy a coffee.
Exactly. That's a flow. You have complete control over it. Second, you have state variables. These are the things you inherit from the past.
So, balance in my bank account.
Right. You can't just snap your fingers and change your bank balance. It's sticky. It describes your current position, which is a result of all your past choices.
I like that. Control variables are my free will. State variables are my baggage.
That's surprisingly philosophical, but yeah, it's accurate. And the Hamiltonian is just a machine for balancing those two. It asks, is the joy I get from my control variable, like drinking this coffee, worth the damage I'm doing to my state variable, my future wealth?
So it's a guilt trip. In equation form.
Basically, yes. And this brings up a big difference in how we think about patience or discounting.
Oh, right. In discrete time, it's always beta, the discount factor.
Right. Beta is a weight. Maybe next year is worth 0.95 to you. But in continuous time, we use a discount rate called rho.
So beta is a weight. Rho is a rate. Why does that matter?
Because rho is like a continuous force, just like an interest rate. It's the rate at which your appreciation for the future is constantly decaying.
Okay, so when you plug this impatience rate, rho, and the interest rate, r, into the Hamiltonian, you get the famous Euler equation.
The Euler equation, yes.
It looks scary, but the explanation felt like a tug of war.
It is a tug of war. The equation basically says the growth rate of your consumption depends on the difference between the market interest rate, r, and your own impatience, rho.
Okay, let's play this out. The market is offering me a 5% return, so R is 5. But I'm a very patient person. My impatience rate is only 2%.
In that case, R is greater than rho. The market is paying you more to wait than it costs you in terms of impatience to wait.
So I should save.
You should save. And the equation says your consumption will actually grow over time. You're delaying gratification, and you'll be able to consume much more in the future.
Okay, now flip it. I'm super impatient. I want everything now, so my rho is 10%. But the bank is only giving me 2%.
Then the reward for waiting is way smaller than the pain of waiting.
Right.
The equation says you should consume heavily now. Your consumption path will actually slope downwards over time. You're effectively eating your future.
It's just fascinating that a differential equation can capture that. It's the marshmallow test in calculus form.
It really is. And the source makes a great point that even though the math looks different, the economic story is identical to the discrete version.
Speaking of stories, let's talk about the big growth models. The source walks through continuous versions of the Solow model and the Ramsey model.
Yeah.
And it felt like a bit of a personality clash between the two.
How so?
Well, the Solow model feels mechanical, almost like a robot economy.
That's a fair way to put it. In the Solow model, people just save a fixed fraction of their income. They don't think, they don't optimize, they just save.
Right. And in continuous time, the model says there's this kind of gravity. If you have very little capital, you grow super fast. If you have too much, you slow down.
Exactly. It's the principle of convergence. The differential equation shows that no matter where you start, you're always being pulled toward a steady state. It's inevitable.
But then we get to the Ramsey model,
Yeah.
and the robots are gone.
Yeah.
Now we have actual thinking agents who are using that Hamiltonian we just talked about.
Yes. The Ramsey model is where it gets really interesting, especially visually, because now we're not just drifting toward a steady state. We have to actively find it.
And this leads to my favorite part of the whole text, the phase diagram and the saddle path.
The saddle path, it's a crucial concept.
Can you just paint a picture of this for us? Because when I hear saddle, I think of a horse.
That's exactly the right image. Imagine a 3D graph shaped like a horse saddle. It curves up from front to back, but it curves down from side to side.
Okay, I'm with you.
Now, if you put a marble right in the very center, the flattest part, it stays put. That's the steady state.
Right.
But if you put that marble just a tiny bit to the left or right, what happens?
It rolls off,
Yeah.
and it rolls off faster and faster.
Exactly. In the Ramsey model, you have capital on the bottom axis and consumption on the side axis. And the math creates this field of arrows that, in almost every direction, point away from that stable center.
So if the economy picks a starting consumption level that's just a tiny bit too high, what happens?
If you start above that saddle path, you consume too much, you're eating your capital, you have a great time for a little while, but you're not replacing your machines. Eventually, capital hits zero, the economy starves.
That sounds bad.
It is.
What if you go the other way?
Yeah.
You decide to be super frugal and you start below this magical path.
Then you're just hoarding capital. You build up all these factories, but you never actually enjoy the fruits of your labor. You drift off into a region of infinite wealth and zero utility. It's completely inefficient.
So you have starvation on one side and pointless hoarding on the other.
And in between, there is one single razor-thin line, the saddle path. If you jump on that exact path, you glide perfectly into the steady state.
Doesn't that make the model seem, I don't know, incredibly fragile? If you miss by a decimal point, civilization collapses.
That's the intuition. It implies that rational agents, people like you and me, have to be smart enough to jump exactly onto that stable path.
That's a lot of faith in my ability to do calculus while I'm at the grocery store.
It is. But the big idea, the first welfare theorem, suggests that perfectly functioning markets, through price signals like the interest rate, will guide us to that path automatically.
So the invisible hand is doing the math for us.
That's the theory.
Okay, so we've covered smooth growth and this perfect razor's edge optimization. But the real world is messy. It's random. How does continuous time handle that?
That's a challenge. In discrete time, you can just say, next period, there's a 50% chance of rain. Easy. But in a continuous flow, you have two main options. You can have constant, tiny little shocks like static on a radio. That's called Brownian motion.
Which the source notes is a bit too heavy for this chapter.
Right. So they focus on the second way, rare discrete jumps, sudden events. And we model this with something called the Poisson process.
The Poisson process, what kind of things is that for?
Think of a light bulb burning out, a scientific breakthrough, or the classic economic example, finding a job.
So you don't know when it will happen, but you kind of know the average frequency.
Exactly. And it has this very specific property called memoryless.
Memoryless. Sounds like me before my morning coffee. What does that mean here?
It means the past doesn't influence the future. It's the classic gambler's fallacy. If you flip a coin and get heads 10 times in a row, what are the odds the next one is tails?
My gut says it's got to be tails. It's due.
But the math says it's still 50-50. The coin has no memory. The Poisson process says that if you're unemployed, the probability of finding a job in the next hour is the same whether you've been looking for 2 days or 2 years.
Huh. That feels a little counterintuitive for job hunting, but I see the point for the model.
For the simple model, yes. And this allows us to model aggregate flows beautifully.
The source uses the bathtub analogy here for unemployment.
Right. Imagine a bathtub. The water flowing in from the tap, That's the flow of employed people losing their jobs. We can call that rate sigma.
Okay.
And the water going down the drain, that's the flow of unemployed people finding jobs. That's rate lambda.
So the change in unemployment is just inflow minus outflow.
Exactly. So even though for any single person, losing a job is a shocking random event, for the economy as a whole, it's just a smooth flow of water in and out. The system settles at a level where the inflow equals the outflow.
So the unemployment rate can be stable at, say, 5%, even though the actual people who make up that 5% are constantly changing.
Correct. Macro stability can emerge from micro chaos.
Wow. We have covered a lot of ground. We've gone from choppy steps to smooth curves. We've seen the dot as our speedometer, the Hamiltonian as our guilt trip machine, and the saddle path as the only way to avoid economic disaster.
It's a completely different lens to view the world through.
So what's the big so what here? Why should our listeners care that economists do this? Is it just to show off with fancy math?
I don't think so. I think it comes down to intuition. Discrete time is great for data because spreadsheets are discrete. But continuous time is often closer to how we actually think. We think in flows. And mathematically, it often gives you a simple, elegant formula, a closed-form solution, instead of some messy simulation.
It just clears away the clutter.
It really does.
Before we go, I want to leave everyone with one final thought from the reading that really stuck with me. It's this term that sounds like it's from a sci-fi movie, the transversality condition.
The TVC.
It sounds super complicated, but it's really about debt and death, isn't it?
It is. In a world with a finite end, if you knew for a fact the world was ending in 10 years, what should you do with your money?
Spend all of it. If I die with $1 million in the bank, I messed up.
Exactly. You want to end with zero. But in these models, we often assume an infinite horizon. Society goes on forever.
So you can't just spend everything because there is no end.
Yeah. Right. So the transversality condition becomes a no Ponzi game condition.
I love that the textbook actually calls it that.
It's the technical term. Think about it. You can borrow on a credit card today, and when the bill comes, maybe you get a second credit card to pay off the first one.
Right. You roll over the debt.
You can do that for a while, but can you do it forever?
My intuition says no.
The math says no, too. The transversality condition basically dictates that you cannot accumulate debt at a rate that is faster than the interest rate forever. Eventually, it has to be paid back.
So whether it's a person, a company, or a government, the calculus sets a hard limit. You can't play a shell game with debt into infinity.
The math always wins in the end.
On that very cheerful note, thanks for diving in with us.
My pleasure.
See you all in the next continuous instant. Take care.